Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals.
Hello, and welcome to the next instalment of Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series. I'm Emily Baxter, Special Counsel in our Sydney office, and I'm here today with Alistair Booth, Kingston Reid's Managing Partner, and Rachel Bevan, Special Counsel in our team. Hi, Alice. Hi, Rachel. It's lovely to be with you today.
And lovely to be with you both, too.
Yes. Hello, everyone.
I think it was Confucius who said, you rarely go wrong when you exercise restraint. But as we know, the federal government has announced that restraint of trade clauses in employment contracts is an area of policy to be considered by the Competition Review. Restraints are a bit of a hot topic at the moment, both here in Australia and abroad. We've heard recently from the US Federal Trade Commission that they've issued a final rule which will ban non-compete clauses nationwide. Under the Federal Trade Commission's new rule, existing non-compete clauses for the vast majority of employees in the US will no longer be valid. What is particularly interesting about the restraint of trade ban in the US is that the ban will extend to senior executive employees as well. Where a senior executive employee has a non-compete clause in an existing contract, that term can remain in force under the Federal Trade Commission's final rule. But employers are banned from entering into new non-compete clauses, even with senior executives. The Australian government's Employment White Paper Roadmap, which was released in September of 2023, outlines the government's intention to investigate non-compete clauses. And it notes some emerging research that non-compete clauses may be restricting workers from switching to better paying jobs and hampering job mobility and innovation. In early April of this year, the government published its issues paper, which was titled Non-Competes and Other Restraints, Understanding the Impacts on Jobs, Business and Productivity. The paper cites some of the themes that have emerged from the Competition Review's Task Force early engagement work on the subject, including firstly what they're calling the chilling effect of restraint clauses on worker mobility, particularly among lower income workers, to choose better paying jobs and the ability of businesses to start up, recruit talent and grow. Secondly, the high cost of litigation, the lack of clear guidance and the use of cascading clauses, which can leave both workers and businesses with an unclear understanding whether an agreed restraint will be upheld as reasonable and enforceable. And thirdly, the economic consequences of potentially inefficient allocation of labour and information which may be hampering productivity growth. Let's start at the beginning. Alice, can you explain exactly what restraint of trade clauses are and why they're significant for employers?
Absolutely, Emily. And these are certainly not new clauses. Restraint of trade is a bit of an umbrella term. And in a moment, I'll go through the three distinct types of restraints that there might be on employees, both during employment and post-employment. But in general terms, a restraint of trade clause is a legal provision in a contract which restricts an employee from engaging in certain activities after they have left the company. The purpose of a restraint of trade clause is always and should only be to protect a legitimate business interest. And I think later in the podcast, we'll come back to that phrase as well. The operation of a post-employment restraint is usually framed with reference to defined industries, businesses, or activities that the employee cannot be involved in or can be involved in, but only in a limited respect. Types of former customers, clients, suppliers, or employees whom the employee cannot contact or solicit. A period of time post-employment during which these restrictions might apply, and a geographical area. They can also be accompanied by what us lawyers call consideration, which everyone else in the world calls payment or called hard cash, either during the employment or after the employment ends. These types of restraints take different forms depending on the protection being sought. And I think one of the concerns that I have about the commentary at the moment is that all restraints seem to be being lumped together in one bucket, whereas there are really distinct and different types of restraints that have different purposes. In broad terms, these are, firstly, non-compete clauses. These non-competes are actually what the FTC in the US appears to have banned. And when you read the policy papers issued by the government and the commentary, really what they are being directed towards is non-competes as well. But a non-compete is restraining a former employee from working for a competitor or establishing a business in direct competition. So that the hint is in the name. That's about not competing with your employer for a particular period of time in a particular area. Then there are what's called non-solicitation clauses. This is about stopping a former employee or restraining a former employee from either or both, soliciting the former employer's clients or customers. So you can go and compete with the employer in a competitive business, but you can't touch these particular customers or clients for a period of time. Or very commonly, soliciting the employees of your former employer. So that's about restraining particularly people in management positions from poaching at their employers, their ex-employers, employees, and getting them to come over with them to a competitor. The last type of restraint is those that deal with a former employee being able to use their employer's confidential information or trade secrets. Now, those types of clauses dealing with confidential information and trade secrets are protected not only through contractual provisions, but also common law protections and the Corporations Act. So it's really important to start our discussion by really referencing and putting some markers around those three distinct type of areas, because it is dangerous to lump them all in together.
That's a good point, Alison. One that I want to return to later in the podcast is the different purposes of each of these types of restraints and how they might be applied differently for different employees or in different situations. Rachel, before we come to that, Alice mentioned, and I think she said it's one of the most important things, or it is the most important thing in terms of the enforceability of restraint of trade clauses, and that is the need to protect legitimate business interests. Can you talk us through exactly what legitimate business interests means?
Yeah, of course, Emily, because as you've both mentioned, it really is the key to understanding the enforceability of a post-employment restraint. So we really do need to start there. Now, at common law, worker restraints of trade are presumed to be against the public interest and therefore void and unenforceable unless they are reasonably necessary to protect the legitimate interests of the employer. Now, there's some slight differences in New South Wales with the Restraint of Trade Act, because you've got specific legislation that deals with that. But we might leave that for another day and just talk more broadly, you know, across Australia and where it sits. So legitimate business interest refers to the specific interest a company legally seeks to protect through such clauses. Now, these interests often include things like safeguarding trade secrets, maintaining confidential information, preserving customer relationships and goodwill, and the protection of staff and staff connection. So it encompasses sort of all of those facets Alice mentioned a bit earlier. And the enforcement of these clauses hinges on proving that the restraint is reasonable and necessary to protect these interests without being excessively restrictive on the employee's ability to work and compete in the industry. There is a public interest element to restraint of trade clauses. And so it's kind of this balancing act between both protecting the legitimate interests of a business, you know, they have a reasonable right to do that, but then also on the other side, protecting the employee's right to work and earn a living, and how far should people go to restrict them from doing that.
And it's really not a new concept. I was actually quite surprised it's getting so much attention now, given that it is a very, very old concept in the common law as well. I mean, one of the seminal cases that's still applied today by the courts in dealing with restraints and the enforceability of the same is an old English case from the House of Lords in 1894. And in that case, the court set the general rule, which, as I said, still applies today, that the public have an interest in every person's carrying on, in those days his, trade freely, so has the individual. All interference with the individual liberty of action in trading and all restraints of trade of themselves, if there is nothing more, are contrary to public policy and therefore void.
So it's an interesting point, Alice. So for at least 130 years, the courts have been balancing the employer and employer needs when considering post-employment restrictions. Against this background, Rachel, what's the government's real concern about restraint of trade clauses then?
Yeah, I think the three points you summarised at the beginning, Emily, are really the primary concerns. There does seem to be an upwards trend in the use of restraint clauses. I know I'm seeing that. We're all seeing that sort of in our practice, but we need to be careful, as Alice mentioned, not lumping them all into one bucket. But I think this upward trend is what brings these concerns to the fore and why they might be getting a bit more attention at the moment. The first issue, as you mentioned, is that there is a concern that the use of these clauses has a negative impact on job mobility. And, you know, that is something that plays an important function in a dynamic and competitive economy. You do need people moving around from role to role. It's sort of how the labour market works, how our economy functions. And the issues paper cites some research papers that have found that job mobility contributes to higher wages for workers because a dynamic labour market enhances their negotiating leverage. And that's particularly beneficial for younger employees who are more likely to find jobs that align better with their skills, resulting in, you know, things that are more commonly cited these days, like positive mental health outcomes. So additionally, younger workers tend to receive the most significant salary increases when they switch jobs, more so than other age groups. The second issue is the way in which restraints are enforced. Now, I mentioned earlier that the test that's applied to determine whether a restraint clause is enforceable. So this is something that ultimately needs to be determined by a court. So this means that where a company seeks to enforce a restraint, legal proceedings are brought, which in our experience can be very time consuming, very costly for both the company and the ex-employee. And subject to the drafting of the clause, the court may sever any unreasonable parts of restraint clause to allow the remainder of the restrictions to survive. So all round, it's rarely a pleasant process for any party involved. So that's sort of the second reason, you know, this is being looked at. Is there a better or a different way that this could be approached? And the third issue raised is the economic consequences of potentially inefficient allocation of labour and information. The issues paper suggests that restraint clauses may disrupt the free movement of workers and non-confidential know-how as kind of like a byproduct of protecting highly valuable know-how and trade secrets, which can then, they say, prevent the best allocation of, you know, business inputs, which then has the impact of hampering economic growth. So the question being asked is whether the benefits companies receive from non-compete clauses balance the broader cost to the economy, individual people who, you know, these clauses are forced upon, or can these benefits actually be accessed in another way? Now, these issues, they weren't plucked from thin air. Emily, what can you tell us about how they actually went about identifying these issues?
You're right, Rachel. I think there was a lot of research, or there is a lot of research being done at the moment into the particular issues. So prior to releasing their issues paper, the competition minister asked both the ACCC and the Treasury for advice on competitive impacts of non-compete clauses particularly. Dr. Ian Ross, who is a name that will be familiar to most of you, is the former president of the Fair Work Commission. He's also a fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences and a board member of the Reserve Bank of Australia. Dr. Ross has prepared a working paper with some interesting data. His paper suggests that almost half of Australian businesses report using at least one type of restraint clauses in their contracts. More than 20% are using non-compete clauses, and 18% are using clauses which prohibit the solicitation of co-workers. Presumably, we can take from that data that a significant number of these restraint clauses relate to non-solicitation of clients or customers and non-disclosure of confidential information, being 20% or 21% using non-compete clauses and 18% solicitation of co-workers. A survey of Australian workers shows that there's a substantial proportion of the Australian workforce that are subject to a post-employment restraint. Dr. Ross's paper cites 22% of Australian workers have a non-compete clause in their contract. And in addition to that, 26% had signed a non-disclosure of confidential information covenant. A further 16% had agreements which restrict the poaching of clients, and 7% had agreements restricting the poaching of co-workers. One of the interesting things that Dr. Ross's research notes, particularly in relation to the non-compete clauses, is that the workers who cite having non-compete clauses come from a range of different income, age, education and occupational groups. And there's a significant proportion of workers with household incomes of less than $100,000 per annum who are impacted by these clauses. Alice, it's interesting data, I think, particularly around the financial thresholds of people. What can we make of the data published in Dr. Ross's paper?
The breakdown of the use of different types of restraints is really interesting. I have to say I was quite surprised by those statistics. It certainly doesn't reflect the experience of practice, I have to say, for the types of employees that you're advising employers to restrain in this type of way. It's particularly intriguing that businesses opt for non-compete clauses over non-solicitation clauses. And both of you know from experience that courts are far more likely to enforce reasonable non-solicitation clauses than non-compete clauses. And courts for many, many years have viewed all types of non-solicitation as being entirely reasonable. because it allows the employee to continue to apply their trade in a competitive business, just not poach the clients or customers of their previous employer. And the non-solicitation clauses are less restrictive in that way. The preference in those statistics for non-compete clauses suggests either that, or both, that businesses are prioritising a broader protection strategy, or perhaps reflects a less targeted approach to the defence of business interests, which I think is probably more accurate. The other piece of data that interests me is the prevalence of non-compete clauses for low-income employees. Perhaps this is that those businesses perceive that even these workers are potential risks if they were to join competitors, that businesses fear that any former employee, regardless of wage level, could possess valuable insights into operational practices, client details, or other proprietary knowledge that could benefit a competitor. But I must say that this approach can seem very disproportionate, as it assumes that a significant potential damage can be done from employees who, based on income level, would have typically far less access to critical business secrets, far less impact with customers and clients, and far more influence to affect the business of their former employee compared to other higher level employees. And I imagine this is what has particularly attracted the concern of the government here and in the US.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, Alice. And I suppose the question that kind of comes to mind then is, do you think that that's a fair reflection of the situation, that regardless of the level of seniority or the position that's held by an employee, the risk to the business if they were to leave to work for a competitor is the same? What we don't see from the statistics or the data reported is the breakdown of the type of restraint by income level.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm not sure that the statistics on the use of non-compete clauses are really a true reflection or representation of the risk to the business at all. When preparing contracts of employment, businesses should really, and many do, choose different restraint clauses for different types of employees to align with the specific risks associated with each role. It isn't necessarily the case that a non-compete clause will be the most legitimate way to protect a business interest. For example, for executives and high-level managerial employees, far more comprehensive non-compete clauses might be used due to their deep knowledge of company strategy, finance and operations, due to the fact that in customer and client sales facing roles, that someone at a very senior managerial level will have deep customer and client relationships and therefore be able to really do damage to their employer's business for a short period after they leave. And the second category is those people in sales roles who may not be executives, but they are sales personnel, so they are market facing. And for those types of people, non-solicitation clauses could be more relevant to protect them from taking clients or other employees with them if they move to a competitor. One industry you see that very commonly in is the recruitment business, for example. Recruitment consultants might not be senior executives, but they do have direct relationships with the clients of their business. So what we more commonly see is a non-solicitation clause to prevent them doing damage to their employer's business for a short period of time after the end of their employment, but not a non-compete clause. So they can go and work for another recruitment company. They just have to use someone else's customers or clients for a period. And also for really technical staff, non-disclosure agreements, more robust confidential information agreements are critical for those in roles involving proprietary technology or trade secrets to safeguard intellectual property. And you can see the clear public policy reasons for those types of clauses. And you've got to take this tailored approach, and taking this tailored approach ensures that protection is proportionate to the potential threat each type of employee poses if they were to join a competitor. And that's what will maximise legal enforceability and effectiveness in protecting a business interest.
As I understand it, one of the possible areas of exploration in regulating restraint clauses is using income thresholds. Justice Ross's paper cites that there's been a strong case for prohibiting the use of non-competes, particularly in respect of low-income workers. And this is a group we've seen reported a lot in the media at the moment. I think gardeners is someone who keeps coming up as a profession or as a job type where restraints perhaps aren't forcible. I've also seen the media reporting dance instructors having...
I saw that way too.
17-year-old dance instructor with a non-compete clause. So the research or the input from Justice Ross notes that a very high monetary enforcement threshold is likely to encounter significant resistance, particularly if it amounts effectively to a de facto prohibition on all non-competes, like we've just seen come out of the US. One of the other suggestions that I've heard is to use the high income threshold as the marker for the use of a non-compete clause in a contract. We know that this is a marker that's already used in a number of different ways to distinguish the rights of differently paid workers. We see, for example, it's used along with a number of other markers for unfair dismissal eligibility. It's used for award or enterprise agreement application with the use of high income guarantees. And most recently, it's been included as a threshold level for independent contractors to opt out of the definitions of employer and employee that are to be inserted in the Fair Work Act shortly this year. Rachel, what do you see, or what's your view on using the high income threshold as the threshold for non-compete clauses?
Yes, well, I agree with the point Alice made earlier about tailoring the approach to restraint clauses. So rather than the relevant attribute being the income of employee, I think you need to go a bit deeper than that and look at the nature of the work being performed and looking at particularly, you know, the access to confidential information and trade secrets, the depth of relationship with customers or clients, or the ability to influence other employees. Probably going to be more relevant to determining the types of post-employment restraints that will best protect legitimate business interest and will more likely be enforceable. So using an income threshold, I don't know, it seems to me to be a little bit too objective, where the consideration of restraints should be subjective. Of course, income level might be a reflection of the nature of the duties assigned to an employee, so I can see why it might be useful, but it isn't necessarily, in my view, the determining risk factor.
Alice, what's your view on using the high income threshold in this way?
I think it's probably where we're going to be landing, to be honest. But I agree that it's, from a matter of simplicity, as you say, it's a marker which has already been used for a number of other rights and obligations with respect to employment, and there's some neatness to using the same figure in respective non-compete clauses rather than coming up with a different threshold altogether. But I do think it's really important to note here that this is a suggestion in relation to non-compete only and not in relation to the other types of restraints. I don't see a good public policy reason for example, confidential information clauses not restraining any employee. I don't think that should relate to income level and to quite a large degree non-solicitation as well. But certainly in relation to non-compete, I can see that there is some simple attraction in applying a high income threshold, one that we're all familiar with. I also think that one thing to think of with the high income threshold is whether that appropriately reflects the earnings and work. So I referred earlier to sales personnel, for example, and if you're a commercial real estate agent, you might be earning $600,000, $700,000, $800,000, $900,000 a year, but your base salary may only be $80,000 a year, with the remainder of that income being made up from sales commissions. And that is not an uncommon structure. Financial services industry is the same, very, very, very low base salary levels, but very, very high incentives. Now, I would hate to see the high income threshold applied to non-competes if it was catch-all and really just applying to a base level and not the commissions and other earnings. So there would need to be some differentiation there, because obviously it doesn't work that way when we look at how the high income threshold is applied in other contexts. So using that marker for non-compete clauses in isolation is not necessarily going to be the most effective way of balancing the needs of business with the needs of employees, as Rachel referred to. The particular role of an employee is going to be really critical to determining what post-employment restraints are necessary to protect legitimate business interests. We've seen out of the US that there are no income thresholds for the ban on non-competes, but it's also really important to remember that the US have got a very, very different legal history with respect to non-competes. They have been out of favour in US jurisprudence for a very, very long time. And they've also been unlawful in a number of significant jurisdictions such as California for a very, very long, very long time. There are also, I've read that there are a number of economists in Australia commenting on this issue in light of the government's review. For senior executives, at least there really does need to be some level of acknowledgement that the parties to the negotiation of an employment contract with significant post-employment restraints are sophisticated and well-resourced. and will receive advice about the terms before they enter into those contracts and are usually paid for those restraints as well. So it's all very well and good to remove non-competes from employment contracts, but that may well see in some examples and some contexts, the remuneration being offered under contracts will be reduced as a result of removing that consideration.
So I think I've heard from both you, Alice, and you, Rachel, that the high income threshold does in some ways provide some simplicity as a marker for non-competes, but perhaps is an oversimplistic way of viewing what is actually the legitimate business interest to protect. And then following from that, what the best way to protect the interest is, having regard to the public policy position that a restraint of trade is invalid, that Rachel and Alice took us to earlier. Alice, we've been speaking about non-competes particularly, but there's also a suggestion that clauses that prohibit the solicitation of former co-workers and employees should be outright unenforceable. What are your thoughts on that?
I find it, again, surprising. I understand that there's a possible policy position for a prohibition on the use of non-solicitation is that these types of clauses may in practice limit a co-worker's ability to reach out to networks from the same business, where networks play a key role in reducing information frictions in the job market. And this suggests that there might be a possible implication on productivity. I don't necessarily think that's a particularly valid conclusion to make. There is a significant cost to business associated with the solicitation of employees in terms of recruitment costs, resourcing constraints and utilisation and productivity, I have to say. It's a very significant dip in productivity when people leave. That needs to be taken into consideration. And it's not a blanket ban on reaching out to your former colleagues. It's just for a period of time. So perhaps that person can just wait the 3 months or the 6 months and then reach out to their former colleague and offer them a job. It's not that big a ask.
Yeah, it's a good point, Alison. One I want to return to is the time limitations on restraint of trades, because you're right, these are not indefinite bans on undertaking these activities.
Yeah. Just wait a few months and then offer him a job. It's fine.
There's a point that you touched on, Alison. It's one that we haven't really focused on much yet today, which is protection of confidential information and trade secrets. Rachel, you've got some thoughts on this particular area.
Yes, I do. Because often an argument raised in support of a non-compete restraint is that the employee may have, you know, knowledge of a business's confidential information and trade secrets, but it's in their mind. So it's not because they've got documents written there, it's just things that they have learnt and absorbed over their time at a company. And so even if they haven't taken any material with them, you know, it's there in their brain. So Alex gave the example earlier of a high-level executive with deep knowledge of the company's strategy, finance, and operations. It then becomes very difficult to monitor the use of that information when it's in someone's mind. And so arguably the best way to do that is to restrict their ability to use the information at all by restricting their employment with a competitor for a period of time.
Alice, you referred to these trade secrets and confidential information in the beginning when you were taking us through the different types of restraint or post-employment obligations. What are your thoughts in respect of protection of confidential information?
Yeah, I do think it's quite different to the other broad policy concerns with non-competes. It's common to have expressed restrictions on the use and disclosure of confidential information in employment contracts. That's very standard. Usually this would be in a standalone clause, and that standalone clause will say it survives the termination of employment, and not necessarily a clause that's lumped in with the rest of any other post-employment restraints. I was surprised by the statistic that you quoted earlier, Emily, that only 26% of respondents to the survey had ever signed a non-disclosure of confidential information covenant. And I wonder whether this is reference to a separate document and not a standard confidential information clause that you might find in any usual employment contract. The other thing to note is that there are prohibitions in the Corporations Act which prevent or prohibit employees from using their position or information to gain an advantage or cause detriment to their employer. So that's a different test, but nonetheless, it is a protection.
And one, Alice, importantly, that applies more broadly than any written contract of employment or any implied contract. The government issues paper notes a different statistic, which is taken from ABS data. Alice, I think might answer your question or your surprise about the 26% of survey respondents noted in Justice Ross's paper. There was an Australian Bureau of Statistics survey conducted in 2023, which reported just over 45% of businesses use non-disclosure clauses for at least some of their workers. The non-disclosure clauses were most used by larger businesses, which is almost 79% of large businesses have non-disclosure clauses or confidential information clauses in their contracts. That same survey also reports more than 81% of businesses which use non-disclosure clauses use them for over three quarters of their workers. So a significant portion of the workforce with non-disclosure or confidential information clauses there. The other interesting thing to come out of that particular survey from the ABS was that non-disclosure clauses are used in all industries across the economy. So they're not kind of restricted to any particular areas. And I think that from our practice, we certainly see that every business has confidential information.
Right.
And it's something that every business wants to protect. So that's unsurprising that they're used in all industries. What we do see, though, is the highest prevalence of the use of the clauses in public administration and safety, financial services, real estate, two industries, Alice, that you've already spoken about today is where that might be important. We also see it in mining and healthcare.
Yeah, that sounds more like our general experience. One of the things I found interesting in the issues paper was the commentary around what the negative impacts of confidential information clauses could be, because when I saw the paper come out, I did think, I wonder what could be the negative impacts of confidential information clauses. And two key issues are raised in the paper. The first is unintentionally disrupting the free movement of workers and non-confidential know-how as a byproduct of protecting the highly valuable know-how and trade secret. That unintentional impact then being preventing the best allocation of business inputs and hampering economic growth. So there it's not so much a problem with protecting the actual confidential information. It's that it is in protecting the actual confidential information, these clauses are going far too broad and protecting information which is not actually confidential. And secondly, imprecisely defining the confidential information intended to be protected from disclosure, and that in turn creates uncertainty, which can result in workers not knowing which information they're allowed to use, while potentially reducing the likelihood of a successful court enforcement of a restraint. Both of those issues, I have to say, can be fixed with better employment contract drafting. They are not issues which should lead to the outlawing of clauses altogether. Those are both issues which should lead to employers drafting better contracts and more properly confining the restrictions on the use of confidential information.
There's something that you mentioned earlier, Alice, that we haven't really spoken about yet, and I wanted to return to, and that is that restraints of in employment contracts are time limited. So as you said, rather than poaching or soliciting your co-workers, just wait the 3 or the 6 or the 12 months that's set out in your contract and then go for your
go crazy.
So in this context where these particular types of restraints or any of these types of restraints really other than confidential information don't apply indefinitely, but are only enforceable for the period that's set out in the contract, what, Rachel, are your thoughts then on really the impact of restraints in terms of why the government's considering this issue now? They really are only a time.
Yeah, they are. And it's very easy to say, oh, these are such a problem without actually looking at what are the specific terms of what they are. They don't last forever. And as Alice mentioned, you know, after a period of time, that ex-employee is free to undertake those activities. They're not indefinite. They don't go forever. But my experience has not been that employees are hesitant to take other opportunities because of restraint clauses, although we do tend to see that this is more likely the case in respect of non-compete clauses. But in my experience, employees are more likely to consider they need to comply with non-solicitation or non-disclosure obligations.
Yeah, I think that's my experience too, is that they will certainly comply with those two obligations or feel themselves compelled or bound to comply with them. But more usual is the experience that employees ignore non-compete clauses or consider them to be unenforceable.
Yeah, and it goes back to the point, I think, of what is the legitimate business interest. And Alice, you raised the point earlier, it's easier to see how a non-solicitation or a non-disclosure obligation might be necessary to protect a legitimate business interest. more broadly than a straight non-compete.
How do you see that people react to restraint clauses, Rach?
Well, I think there are a couple of ways that employees and employers may respond to restraint clauses. You know, firstly, an employee might proactively approach their employer, you know, and ask to be released from at least some of the obligations. So, you know, they've lined up another job. They, you know, come forward and say, you know, I'm commencing employment with this other, my new employer, future new employer. Can you release me, you know, from some or all of the obligations? And look, the old employer may be happy to do that when they understand what the role is and who they're going to work for. And so they may release them from, you know, some of the non-compete obligations, but then remind the employee of their other obligations that still remain. You know, they may, you know, not release them from the non-solicitation and, of course, the non-disclosure obligations. Secondly, an employer might become aware that an employee has gone to work for a competitor. And I know we often see this in practice where something pops up on LinkedIn and you go, wait, there's my former employee has gone running off to my competitor. Working for that competitor might not be an issue in itself. They might have been able to do that. But for the former employer, it's the non-solicitation and the non-disclosure obligations that the old employer wishes to enforce, you know. So what can that former employee say and do now that they're at a competitor? Often in the case, in practice, it's the first step is a letter reminding the employee of these obligations. And that might be all it takes, you know, to remind that person of what they're required to do under their previous contract and then to, you know, to protect the interests of the business. Sometimes, though certainly less commonly in my experience, an old employer will seek to enforce a non-compete clause and have an employee either resign from their new employment or reject an offer with a new employer so that they can comply with the contractual restraints. And that's probably at the most serious end of the spectrum. And then the other way a business might approach an employee acting in breach of a restraint clause is to commence litigation. And that's sort of, this is the final step that you might take by, you know, approaching the court and seeking an injunction which requires the employee to comply. But that's certainly not a step to take lightly.
It sounds, Rach, like from what you're saying, even at the point of seeking to enforce a restraint, a business usually in our experience would still be considering what is their legitimate business interest to protect, and even against the clauses in the contract, which of those clauses are really necessary to protect that interest. So it does seem from a practical perspective that businesses are taking that more nuanced approach to respond to potential threats or risks to their businesses and employees leaving. Mm. Of course, it's also open to employers to not take any steps to enforce a restraint if they don't see that there's a need to have an employee comply with particular obligations that are set out in their contracts. Alice, before we conclude today, do you have any final thoughts on restraints to share?
Yeah, I think for me, it's a very boring and very practical observation, but I really believe that when I look at those statistics for the number of people who've apparently got restraints in their employment contracts, a massive contributor to that prevalence of restraint clauses that aren't fit for purpose is the use of pro forma or template contracts of employment. Now, you can buy these off the internet for, you know, $1,000, and they'll have every clause known to mankind that was ever in an employment contract in that contract. And small businesses in particular will just churn them out. Small and medium businesses will churn these template contracts out to their employees without ever tailoring them or understanding whether or not that's appropriate. And those clauses, and I've seen them, they do have these very far-reaching restraints in them. And I think when you hear an example about a gardener or a hairdresser that was called out by the minister of having a non-compete clause, I will bet you that contract was bought off some online provider. It was a template contract and they just filled in the name and the remuneration. Employment contracts are serious. I know I would say that. I'm an employment lawyer who drafts them. But putting all self-interest aside, they are important documents. And when you're dealing with an important clause, like a restriction on an employee post the termination of their employment, they've got to be fit for purpose. And it's obvious from those statistics that people are using contracts that aren't fit for purpose.
I don't know whether that needs a question, whether that needs a legislative reaction or solution, but that certainly is a problem which I think is contributing to those statistics and those issues that we're seeing in the issues paper.
Well, Rachel, Alice, thank you. It's been great to chat with you both today about restraints of trade and in the particular context of the current review that's being undertaken by the government. I think you'll both agree we need to mark this particular issue as a watch this space. There's still more to come on restraints of trade, and I think we'll still see a lot of media about it over the coming months. The government's scheduled some further consultation for April and May of this year, with the expectation that the competition review will advise the government on the outcomes of that consultation sometime in June to December of 2024. Rachel, Alice, thanks for being with us today, and thank you all for joining us for this session of A Kingston Reads, A Word to the Wide podcast. You can listen and subscribe to our podcast wherever you usually get your podcasts from.
Thanks very much.
Bye.
See ya.